Now let's turn our hearts and our minds to God's Word.
The first reading is from the fifth chapter of Ephesians. Paul writes, "For once you were darkness, but now in the Lord you are light. Live as children of light. For the fruit of the light is found in all that is good and right and true. Try to find out what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what such people do secretly, but everything exposed by the light becomes visible. For everything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it says, 'Sleeper, awake, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine in you.'" The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
The second reading is from the 27th chapter of Psalms. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and foes, they shall stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war rise up against me, yet I will be confident. One thing I asked of the Lord, that I will seek after: to live in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will set me high on a rock. The word of the Lord, the light of Christ. Thanks be to God. We would like to invite our children down for children's worship through this door on our left.
The Lord is my light and my salvation. Of whom should I be afraid? Of whom should I be afraid? The Lord is my light and my salvation. Of whom should I be afraid? Of whom should I be afraid?
Please stand for the reading of the gospel. And now I'm going to invite you to sit down. Have a seat. Lutherans love to stand for the gospel. I just thought it'd be sort of humorous to at least get you up and down. I mean, it's good. It's good for you. Today, we are in the midst of a series, a sermon series called Encounter, in which we're taking a look at some of the stories from the Gospel of John, in which Jesus encounters men and women who are facing something in their lives. It could be darkness, it could be death, something that just begs from Jesus a new understanding of who he is and a new understanding of who they are. Today, we're taking a look at the 9th chapter of John, and I'm having you sit during this reading because it is the second longest story in all of the Gospels. It is a long one, and yet it's filled with beautiful intrigue and detail, and I know that we'll thoroughly enjoy unpacking it a bit today. But as we prepare to sort of encounter the story, I'd like to place an image before you, if you don't mind. It's the image of Sonia and Anita. Sonia and Anita are two girls, sisters from India. They come from a village that is desperately poor, and their parents, working parents, but desperately poor. They really can't afford much of anything except maybe some clothing, simple clothing and food, sustenance for their life. But Sonia and Anita were born blind. But thanks to medical technology and sort of the beauty of living in this day and age, there is a medical procedure that for only $300 each, they can receive their sight. Their sight can be restored, but their parents are too poor. They don't have the resources to afford anything like that. And so in comes a nonprofit global organization called 20-20-20. They go into places like this, into the desperately poor villages of the world, and they bring this technology to girls like Sonia and Anita. Now, National Geographic had cameras in place during their surgery. And there's a beautiful clip. I would encourage you. I really want you to go home and Google, if you can find it, National Geographic, Sonia and Anita, two girls who were born blind, whatever you might want to search. But you'll see that the cameras are in place as the bandages are removed from their eyes, and they are able to encounter light for the very first time. It's beautiful. I mean, it's just stunning, really. I want you to place that image before you as we take a look at this story, a story of a man born blind. I want you to place that image of Sonia and Anita, these desperately poor little girls whose bandages are just gently pulled from their eyes, and with joy in their face and their expressions, they are seeing for the very first time. We're going to be taking a look at a story, again, of a man who is born blind. And as you keep that picture in mind, I want you to know and give thanks for a gospel writer, John, who shares with us this story as a way of sort of allowing us to see that Jesus is eager to heal this man's physical blindness, but in a much more beautiful and broader sense, is eager to heal all of our spiritual blindness. So today, the man born blind. I invite you to open up in your bulletins, or perhaps you have your Bibles with you today, to John chapter 9. We're going to walk through this story together. As Jesus walked along, Jesus was in Jerusalem. He was outside the temple. He had been teaching there for the last number of days because there had been a festival that so many folks from the region had come to celebrate. As Jesus walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." It's important to know at this point in the story that as unfair as this may seem, they were part of a system, a cultural system that believed that someone who had a disability or severe illness, that disability was caused by their own sinfulness, or if not their own sinfulness, the sinfulness of their parents. And so the community would look down upon this man born blind with an element of scorn. Again, hardly fair, right? Especially in our modern day understanding of things. And yet, that's how folks encountered this gentleman. That's all he knew. I mean, every day when he woke up and found a way to make it to the temple with maybe a tin cup in his hand, I don't know. And every day, 7 days a week, begging for money just to have enough so maybe to have a meal before he went to bed at night. The rest of the community had pushed him aside and marginalized him because he was a sinner, or he had come from a sinful family. Then verse 6, when he had said this, when Jesus had said this, he spat on the ground and he made mud with the saliva, and he spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. Then he went and washed and came back able to see. You know, here's a funny thing, and I hesitate to mention this on Boy Scout Sunday, but I mean, spit? Really? I mean, saliva? Doesn't that sort of like, I mean, why does he choose that detail in the story? I mean, Jesus has already proven that he can heal. He can do whatever he wants with just words from his mouth. And yet in this case, he chooses a prop. But couldn't he have chosen a prop other than spit? I mean, when I was like, I don't know, 9, 10, 11 years old, we use spit for anything and everything. I mean, right? I mean, how many of you were in the same kind of English class that I was in, and we just had spitball fights, it seemed like, every single day? I don't know if they allow that anymore, but you'd come in the next day, and you'd have these dried-up spitballs on the walls all around the classroom. Or then, and I know this will be offensive to some, but how many of you have had spit wars, right? Or to figure out exactly how far you can spit, right? You have spitting contests. And it wasn't always spit that you were pulling up, right? It was whatever you could pull up. In any case, for those of you who have not been there, boys, you've got afternoon activities for you today. In any case, I find it humorous that Jesus has chosen this sort of prop to bring us into the story. Spit. Why spit and mud? And yet, it's beautiful. Because in some respects, it conjures up for us a reminder, a memory of what God does in the very beginning of time, in the first part of Genesis. If you remember that story, you remember what Jesus does, how he forms Adam from the ground? He forms Adam from mud, that he is like a sculptor. He is sculpting together into Adam, and then he breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. I mean, that's how Adam is given form. That's how Adam is given life. And so here he does the same thing in order to give this man sight. He makes mud and rubs it into his eyes. I just wonder if Jesus is thinking while he's performing this miracle, I am the potter and you are the clay. Then Jesus told him to go wash in the pool of Siloam, and when he does, he lifts his head up out of that water and he can see. It's sort of like Anita and Sonia. If you have a chance to see that video, just the beauty of these girls seeing for the very first time. There's a lovely little scene of Sonia walking by the river, and there are all these reeds that are just blowing in the wind, and she's so captivated. She's just touching and feeling them all, sort of encountering life for the very first time. Verse 8. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some were saying, "Yeah, it's he." Others were saying, "No, but it must be somebody like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." But they kept asking him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" And he answered, "That man called Jesus, he made mud, he spread it in my eyes. And he said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' And then I went and I washed and I received my sight." And they said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, I don't know. I couldn't see." Right? They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also began to ask him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "Look, he put mud in my eyes, then I washed, now I see." Period. End of sentence, right? I mean, he's a typical guy. He's just giving you just the bare bones facts. That's all you need to know, right? "He put mud in my eyes, and now I see." Period. End of sentence. What's interesting is he's really sort of neutral in this particular part of the story. He's not on the side of Jesus. He's not on the side of the religious authorities. He's completely neutral. I mean, he's not making any commentary whatsoever. He just knows that he now can see. Verse 16. Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not observe the Sabbath," because you're not officially supposed to be healing on the Sabbath. But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner perform such signs?" And they were divided amongst themselves. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him? It was your eyes he opened." And he said, "Well, he must be a prophet." Which is interesting, isn't it? Because suddenly now, he's not neutral. I mean, in John's gospel, this gospel of John is a beautiful gospel, and it's centered around seven stories. That's all, for the most part. And in each of those seven stories, Jesus encounters someone. And in that encounter, these people grow to better understand who Jesus is and who they are. Now, for some people, it takes a while. For Nicodemus, it took 2-3 years. For others, it took several days or several other experiences. In this case, this man at first does not know who Jesus is, but he's growing in his knowledge. And so at this point, he's already beginning to say, well, he must be a prophet. He's growing in his understanding of who Jesus is. Now skip to verse 24. So for the second time, the Pharisees called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, "Give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner." He answered, "I do not know whether he's a sinner, but one thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." Then they reviled him, saying, "Ah, you must be his disciple. But we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." And then the man answered, here's an astounding thing. You got to love this. I mean, this guy's been sitting in the temple, blind, right? He doesn't even have a name. We're never even given the privilege of his name. He's a guy who has been set aside by society all of his life. He's been ignored by everyone in all of Jerusalem all the days of his life. Now, however, with boldness, he's preaching. And he's not just preaching to anybody. He's preaching to the religious authorities of Jerusalem, to the Pharisees who have gathered there, and he's standing up as the greatest preacher in the world. Here's an astounding thing, he says. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but he does listen to one who worships him and obeys his will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, "You were born entirely in sin, and you're trying to teach us?" Well, yeah, and he's doing a good job of it, I think, right? But what happens next? They drove him out. They drive him out of the temple. This man who had been hoping and praying all of his life, probably every morning when he rose up, hoping and praying that his sight would be restored. Finally, it is, and what's the first thing that happens? They throw him out of the community. How brutally sad. But Jesus heard that they had driven him out. And when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And the man said, "And who is he, sir? Tell me so that I may believe in him." And Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Such a beautiful part of the story. That even though the community has thrown him out of town, Jesus tracks him down. Jesus finds this man, and he engages in this lovely, very personal conversation. Look, there's a lot that we can unpack in this story, but I just have two brief things that I'd like to share with you about it. The first is the way that Jesus introduces us to the story. So take a look at the first few verses once again. Verse 1, they're walking along, and there's this man who is blind, right? Which means he's living in darkness. Literally, he's living is as if you closed your eyes, and that's all you experienced all of your life, right? You're literally living in darkness. But more than that, he is also defined by darkness. Verse 5, Jesus says, "Listen, I have come to show you that your story does not have to be defined by darkness, because I am the light of the world." Isn't that beautiful? If you've ever read John, you know that this isn't the first time that he's ever used this phrase. In the very first chapter of John, John introduces us to Jesus with the exact same phrase. In verses 4 and 5 of chapter 1, it says, "What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it." And then just before this story in chapter 8, so right now we're in chapter 9, just before it in chapter 8, Jesus is still in Jerusalem. He's outside the temple, and he encounters this woman who's been caught in adultery. She's not just been accused. She has been caught in an adulterous relationship. Now, adultery is bad in any age, but especially in this age, I mean, they did not look too lightly upon it. In fact, my guess is the stones were already in the hands of the men who had gathered around her. Their responsibility, or so they felt, was to root the community of this kind of sin. And so they were going to root the community of this woman. They were going to get rid of her by stoning her to death. But Jesus approaches her, and he sees deep within her something that no one else really has ever seen. Now, as the community is defining her by her past, Jesus is looking deep inside her and defining her by her future, right? No one has ever cared about her that way. No one has ever spoken to her in that way. Jesus says to her, "I am the light of the world." I mean, this is a woman who's been living in darkness for a long time, right? "I am the light of the world," he says to her in a very personal way. "Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life forever." It's beautiful. You know, John's gospel is interesting because even though Jesus lived for, what, 30, 32, 33 years? We don't know. But of all that time, John's gospel only tells 21 days of Jesus' story. That's it. Which tells us that there's a lot of detail that is left out. There are so many stories, so many teachings, so many sayings that are not included in John's gospel, of course. It's impossible to capture it all. Only 21 days. And other than his death and resurrection, then most of it is focused on these seven encounter stories. So what we're seeing here is the reason why John is writing his gospel in the first place, so that people, and that includes you and me, that includes generations before us and generations after us, so that all of us might see Jesus as the light of the world, that we might see Jesus as the way and the truth and the life. He's telling us over and over again in every one of these encounter stories that without Jesus, you cannot know the truth. And without Jesus, you cannot understand and experience the fullness of God's light. Well, here in chapter 9, he gives us the best illustration up to this point. I mean, here's a man. He's born blind. He's living in darkness. And you know what that means, right? It means he's been abandoned. He's been marginalized. He's been pushed off to the side. He's been overlooked. He's been looked upon with scorn. Even his family has abandoned him, right? I mean, nobody cares about this guy. He's a non-entity. If we don't even give him a name, the privilege of having a name. It's a very dark world that this man lives in. Not just literally, but figuratively. It's a very dark place. But that's his world. That's all he knows. And here's the point. He literally cannot reach beyond that place of darkness without Jesus. Now, you know as well as I that there are a lot of people who live in that very dark place. There may be people in this very room who live in that world of utter darkness. Friends, Jesus comes to you today to be the light of your world. But here's what's curious. Does he have to do anything in order to be healed? No. I mean, is there any indication that he deserves it? None. I mean, we don't know anything else about his story. There's no indication. Jesus simply approaches this man who the world has claimed is without merit. Jesus just comes up unannounced to this man who the world has claimed is without hope, and he changes his life, and he removes the bandages from his eyes. You know, there's a lot out there in this world today, right? There's a lot out there that wants to try to tell you where you can find truth and where you can find light. You know that there's a lot. The world wants to tell you that you can find the ultimate truth in power and wealth and influence. And there's no doubt that power and wealth has contributed a lot of good to this world. But man, it's contributed a lot that's bad and a lot that's evil in this world too. The world, though, continues over and over, day by day, to desperately try to convince you that if you want to find truth, you got to find it in other places. But today, Jesus draws you close. He draws me close in yet another encounter story, but this one, not a story of 2,000 years ago, but a story of today. Jesus draws you close and says, friends, please, my sons and daughters, don't be misled. Because if you allow the world to continue to mislead you, you're going to continue to walk with blurred vision. But see, Jesus is the light of the world. A light no darkness can overcome. Real briefly, just one more thing. Did you notice the title of this story? I mean, if you have a Bible, you'll see it here. And my guess is every Bible has it titled in the exact same way. It's the way I learned it, even as a kid, this story. The title is, anyone want to guess? A Man Born Blind. That's the title of the story, A Man Born Blind. Isn't it a shame that he continues, even to this day, to be identified by his past? I mean, isn't that a shame? There's a man that Kristen and I know from our previous congregation, Johnny Good. His wife was Mary Good. Johnny Good was probably the wealthiest man in our congregation, not necessarily of money. I mean, he might have had a lot of money, but he was wealthy by land. He was the largest landowner of anyone on Apple Pie Ridge, which is a fruitful area of the northern Shenandoah Valley. Now, Johnny, though, as I got to know him, did not have an easy story, didn't have an easy life. In fact, when he was a young boy, both of his parents died, and he was placed in an orphanage. Now, Johnny was short, he was small, and when he was a kid, he was particularly small, and so he was always called a runt, and he was always bullied, and he was always beat up. And when he went to school, because even at the orphanage, he would continue to go to school, the public schools. From that moment on, right, he was no longer identified as Johnny. What was he identified as? The orphan. The orphan. And he hated it. Nobody ever called him by his name. He was always called the orphan. He couldn't wait to get out of school. I mean, he just waited for that day when he finally could essentially escape. He didn't graduate from high school, but he essentially escaped. And he didn't have any family. He didn't have any friends to go to. So he just worked. He worked as hard as he could. The only place he could find a job was on the farms. And from the very beginning, he decided that there is only one way that I can make a life out of this, and it's if I own land. So he started to piece together as much money as he could. And after several years, he had enough to buy a small little parcel of land. Over the next 50 to 60 years, he would continue to add to that parcel of land, so that by the time I went out on to his house one time, the first time I ever visited him, he took me out on his back deck and he said, "Look to the left." I looked to the left. "I own everything you possibly can see, all the way up and down the valley." "Look to your right." I looked to the right. "I own everything you can possibly see." At this portion of the valley. Everything that he could lay his eyes on, he owned. And admittedly, he said that with quite a bit of pride. But I asked him, "Johnny, what motivated you to buy all this land?" And he said very honestly, "I was tired of being known as the orphan. I was tired of being known as the orphan." Friends, if you don't hear anything else today, if you don't have anything else, I want you to take home this. Jesus doesn't want you to be known as an orphan. Jesus doesn't want you to be known as the blind man. Jesus doesn't want you to be known by the darkness of your past. Jesus doesn't want you to be known as someone who is ugly or someone who is unlovable. No. If Jesus is the light of the world, he wants to welcome you out of darkness into the dawn of a brand new day, right? I mean, he doesn't want for you a life that is marked by darkness or blindness or death. He wants for you a life that is marked by hope and resurrection and new life and new opportunities and new beginnings. Why? Because once I was lost, but now I am found. Once I was blind, but now I see. Jesus wants to remove whatever bandages are covering your eyes today. And I want to invite you to look to Jesus as those bandages are removed. Maybe for the first time in your life, to open those eyes and see who is staring at you. Jesus, the light of the world, the light no darkness will overcome. Amen.